This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. NASCAR roars, at least partially out of Loudoun, bills to raise the marriage age to 18 and to add anti-discrimination protections for people who are transgender stall in the New Hampshire House. The fight over how to repeal and replace Obamacare revs up in Washington, and fasten your seatbelt or not, it's been a busy week in politics. Good morning, all. Joining us this week is Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press. Why don't we start with the State House yesterday? Fat calendar this week, lots of bills, according to the Speaker, too many roll call votes. I think it's fair to say a lot of the emotional energy was spent on the bill to add housing, employment, and public accommodation protections for people who are transgender. That bill ended up on the table, tantamount to killing it. Why don't we walk through what happened, Kathleen?
Yeah, so this bill had come out of committee with a strong bipartisan recommendation. I think it was 15-2 that it should pass. And some opponents of the bill, I think, created a very effective campaign to target lawmakers. Lawmakers were getting hundreds and hundreds of emails, phone calls from constituents on both sides. But, you know, given that it is a Republican legislature, I think groups like the conservative group Cornerstone seem to have a lot of sway over this. They were focusing really on this public accommodations piece, which has to do with you know, saying if someone's in a restaurant, they can't be discriminated against. But they were really focusing it in on this bathroom argument. So Speaker Sean Jasper decided that he didn't like this bill and didn't want to have a debate on it. So what they moved to do yesterday is put it on the table, which effectively says we can't debate it. We can't have an up or down vote on it. All you can do is these parliamentary inquiries, which are sort of strangely worded and hard to understand. And all day it was kind of this maneuvering to see if Democrats could have the votes to get the bill off the table so they could have a debate on it. They ultimately tried to do so around 5:30 p.m. and were not successful. So going forward, if there is to be a debate on this, I think they need just a simple majority to get the bill off the table, but they would need two-thirds support of the chamber to pass it. So it becomes much harder going forward to actually get this bill to go anywhere. So it's effectively dead for the year.
And Speaker Jasper came out early in the week and said, I don't want to debate this bill. This bill isn't ready. Why don't we listen to what Speaker Jasper said earlier in the week about his concerns about the bill? Okay,
I believe that if, as a husband or a father, my daughter or my wife is in a restroom and someone who comes up who clearly looks like a man to me attempts to go in there, I'm going to do the natural thing as a husband or father and say, excuse me, my wife, my daughter's in there, I'm going to ask you not to go in. But that person, under this law, would have the right to say, hey, I have a right to go in there, I'm going in there. The natural instinct is going to be to say, no, you're not. Ultimately, the person who stopped somebody from going in there trying to protect his family is going to be the one who's going to be charged. I think that's wrong. I think people who have not fully transitioned to their new identity need to be respectful of the vast majority of us and recognize if they do not look like a person of the sex they're trying to transition to, they don't have the right to use a bathroom.
Okay, that was House Speaker Sean Jasper earlier in the week, prior to the sort of machinations on the floor. Kind of a lot to unpack there, but it seems that, the argument he's making is both the public safety one, which we've heard, which backers of this bill suggest is ill-founded. We also hear kind of an aesthetic argument from him that if one is transgender and they don't look sufficiently like the gender they're transitioning to, then hold it as you're going into if you want to use the bathroom.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting argument to make, right, that he's essentially saying we should base someone's rights based on how they look. And obviously none of that ended up being debated. You know, there was an interesting thing going on in that he obviously was opposed to the bill, but rather than saying, let's debate it and let's have these arguments and let's take a vote, he was also arguing that it just wasn't worth the House's time to spend an hour or so, whatever it would have been, debating this bill. So you're right that there's a lot to unpack there in what Sean Jasper was saying.
Yeah, a little bit of broader context on this. You know, this issue of transgender rights has really become the new battleground in the culture wars. Once the Supreme Court weighed in on gay marriage, the focus really shifted to this, and we've seen a number of big debates in North Carolina, Texas. We saw the Trump administration recently remove federal guidance put in place by the Obama administration. So this really has become kind of a central battleground. And we saw, I think it was this bill where, you know, this initially had support, and then a number of state legislators reported receiving a lot of basically form emails sent to them. And those can really come from anywhere in the country. So there is an element of kind of national focus on this, as we've seen play out in other states. I thought it was interesting that they didn't basically, I understand they had a lot of bills to get through yesterday, but to not allow any debate on it. Governor Sununu says he has no position on it, which is an interesting statement in itself. So this is not the last we've heard of this, though. This is a central issue now.
No, we had a good preview of where it could go eventually when it is debated, because the majority leader, Dick Hinch, who basically had the task of corralling the Republicans and making sure they stayed in their seats yesterday, had an amendment in his shirt pocket that he was going to bring forward had the matter come up. And it would have been an amendment providing some exclusion to the rights should they be granted relative to bathroom access. They were actually going to focus on a bathroom exclusion.
Why don't we listen to one of the things that Majority Leader Hinch said to us in the hall yesterday, midday.
As husbands and fathers, we have, you know, very grave concerns about making sure that, you know, our wives and daughters are adequately protected. But we shouldn't also forget that, you know, when we have young teenagers that all of a sudden decide, you know, as a prank or whatever, to go into, you know, the ladies' showers, and the hormones are raging, okay, I mean, that's real world, and they would be able to get away with that because I felt like a woman today.
All right, that was Majority Leader Dick Hinch, a representative from Merrimack. Again, he seems to be, you know, there's a lot of this kind of husband and a father language among a lot of the House Republicans, and, you know, you have the demographic issue of the House, the average age, I think it's 61. You know, obviously they were taken by surprise by the committee vote in support of this bill, but it ought to be said that some of the supporters include the Association of Police Chiefs, the Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence, and the Business and Industry Association. And probably ought to be said as well that this bill, based on its sponsorship and Democrat support for it, would have passed in the state Senate. And so, you know, what Governor Sununu would have done with it, like, you know, we don't know. But for people who wanted to kill this thing, the House was the best place to do it.
Yeah. And I also think it's just really important to note some of the things in the bill. You know, people are crafting this as, oh, if you just say, oh, this is how I feel today, then you're fine. I mean, there's a definition of gender identity in that bill that says, you know, being able to show that it's a sincerely held belief about who you are. And yes, there are questions about how enforceable that is, but it's, you know, I think it attempts to not just say anyone can do anything at any time. And it's boiled down to this issue over bathrooms, but this bill also deals with housing and employment. So this bill says that you can't be denied housing somewhere because you're transgender, that you wouldn't, you know, if you were fired because you're transgender, you have some recourse. So it's become this question over bathrooms, but it's really about a lot more than that. And there are a lot of people who showed up to testify sharing stories about how when they did announce that they would be transitioning or that they were transgender, you know, that they were publicly mocked or lost their jobs. And I think it's important to note that, you know, yeah, this is about more than just bathrooms.
These kind of big national culture war debates typically don't have a lot of nuance, and it gets reduced to sort of the caricature on both sides of sort of the fear and threat and the kinds of arguments that we typically end up talking about bathrooms rather than these other issues that you mentioned.
But just in terms of the parliamentary maneuvering, it is interesting, having covered the last time this was debated in Concord, which was back in 2009 when Democrats controlled the House. And a similar bill was filed, and Democrats hoped to pass it. Republicans were fighting it, and there were 5 hours of debate on the floor over 2 days. There were 20 separate roll calls, 3 moves to table it, and it ended up passing by a single vote, and that was after then-Speaker Terry Norelli hit the floor to join the debate. And, you know, when it got to the Senate, people were potentially fearing the politics of it. The Senate agreed to kill it 24-0, essentially amid lots of finger-pointing, and certainly some of the yesterday's parliamentary moves were fairly baroque. The majority controls the process, and they use that to achieve their end. It was interesting to watch. And to that extent, we do have a question on Twitter, which is, how do we help 400 representatives learn about an issue and decide to vote without party leadership bullying them? That's a question we got from Twitter. One person who spoke out during the tabling, who was around back in 2009, was State Rep Jackie Silley. Back then, she was in the state Senate, and when the bill went down there, stood up and sort of chastised pretty much everyone in the room, people on the Senate floor, blamed the media for using the terminology bathroom bill. Why don't we listen to what she said yesterday?
We have heard these arguments before. They're tired. They are of a yesterday perspective. It's time to move this state forward and get into the 21st century. And as I said, the thing that bothers me most is not whether the bill survived or died. It's the fact that this is a cowardly way to treat something that people in this state are so passionate about.
All right, that was State Rep Jackie Silley of Barrington. It is interesting to, process-wise, the decision to table it did forestall what would have been a long debate. David mentioned the amendments that leadership are proposing to carve out the accommodations. I expect this bill to come back, certainly.
It'll come back, but they won't have the two-thirds votes.
Oh, no, not this
on
year.
But... So it's doubtful whether it will come up for a full debate. The speaker pulled out all of the parliamentary stops he could on this one. First of all, to preclude debate by recognizing a motion to table, which essentially was a device to size up where the votes were on this issue. And then, as the day wore on, in order to prevent the session from going so late into the night that they might lose some much-needed Republican members, they moved the early adjournment and proceeded to table a large number of bills, many of which had ought to pass recommendations, prompting the Democratic majority leader to say, what's going to happen with all these bills? And that's unclear because the speaker said, well, they've been tabled without prejudice. So we assume that means they can be brought back. But there's a little uncertainty surrounding all of those issues.
So those
right
bills
now
remain on the table. That was unclear to me from listening.
I think what happened, first of all, just to the question the person asked on Twitter, all of the state representatives' email addresses and phone numbers are available online, so on the general court website. So whatever side you're on, these people are accessible if you want to get in touch with them. My impression was, a lot of bills had come off the consent calendar, which is bills that everyone pretty much agrees what direction they're going. They probably don't need to be debated, but it's a pet issue for somebody who wants to ensure that it's debated or a roll call vote happens. And at the end of the day, just very quickly, they started rushing through all of these bills that had been on consent and just throwing them on the table. And I think it was, again, to ensure that the session ended, that people
before
didn't
people
leave.
Before people left. And then,
you could, try and pull things off the table. But it's unclear to me now, what happens with those bills. I think they're all going to need a two-thirds vote to come off. I'm not exactly sure. It was, I've never seen anything like it, the way covering the legislature for, the past 4 years, the way that they move to just table probably a dozen bills, in very quick succession. So it was definitely odd, and I'm not really sure what happens with those bills going forward.
All right, why don't we go to the phones? Michael's on the line from Concord. Good morning, Michael. Go ahead.
Good morning. Does anybody find it interesting that we can discriminate against people who have a sincerely held belief about their gender, but people who have sincerely held religious beliefs, according to the Hobby Lobby decision, can discriminate against anybody? And the question that comes to mind is, how do you test whether someone's beliefs are sincerely held?
That's a tough one, Michael.
Inquisition?
One person's right of conscience is another person's, horrible way of thinking. But you raise an interesting question.
I think the legal question is, how do you test whether someone's beliefs are sincerely held?
That's beyond my pay grade, as I say. But thanks for calling, Michael.
Well, I think the caller raises the point that is often used by opponents of the transgender rights legislation, wherever they may be, which is, how can we tell this person really has in their heart that they are not the sex that they were biologically born with, or that they're just saying that?
But I mean, certainly this issue comes up whether you're talking about, you know, mandates of, you know, sex education in school, vaccines, you know, some statutes hold that it has to be a sort of a religious objection. Some, you know, may give you a right of conscience, but, you know, defining somebody's state of mind that comes up in voting as well is murky.
We'll get to that on the voting.
All right. We have an email. This is from Anonymous. Why safety security issues do women see here? If anyone exposes themselves in any other place, that would be a sex offender. But somehow a transgender person should be treated differently under the law. Two, how many instances of documented transgender discrimination have there been in the state of New Hampshire? Thank you, Anonymous. You know, that was a point on the opponents of the bill said that there isn't a long record of documented transgender discrimination. Certainly people who testified in favor of the bill said that they had been discriminated against. The New Hampshire Human Rights Commission executive director was in favor of this bill.
Yeah, and he said that they have taken some transgender discrimination cases before, even though gender identity is not specifically in that law right now. I don't know. I don't know specifically what the number of those cases would be. But I do think definitely some women showed up to testify against the bill, and they raised concerns, you know, about how they would feel being in a bathroom with someone who was transgender. But I think the vast majority of the comments about protecting women in women's bathrooms, at least that we saw here in New Hampshire, tended to come from men.
All right. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. That was not the only sort of hot issue on the agenda yesterday. And Kathleen, you mentioned the consent calendar, which is something where things that normally are non-controversial, and if they get pulled off the consent calendar, which any rep can request, rarely does a committee report get overturned. They're often, you know, 18-0, 17-1, something like that. One that did actually yesterday was on the issue of New Hampshire's marriage statute.
Yeah, this came about quite as a surprise. This had an 11-0 support of the committee and was on the consent calendar, meaning it was clustered in with a bunch of bills that were just supposed to sail through as the session got underway. Every representative has the right to, anyone can pull one of those items off and say, no, I want this on the floor for a full debate. And at the very last minute, Representative Dave Bates from Windham pulled the marriage bill off the consent calendar. And it was debated very late in the session. And the argument, which wasn't made in the hearings, by the way, was made that this would have two adverse effects. It would increase the number of out-of-wedlock childbirth, and it would affect the ability of young veterans, young military personnel, to marry before being deployed or what have you, should they want to marry someone younger than 18, and be eligible for benefits. And so this had a real effect on swaying the vote to defeat the measure.
All right, more on this after the break. Stick around. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange.
Just because you binge-watched West Wing does not mean you understand how government works. And that is okay. NHPR's new podcast, Civics 101, reviews the fundamentals that you learned in school and then forgot. Like, what exactly does a chief of staff do?
Most presidents don't like firing people.
Subscribe to Civics 101 on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Schoolhouse Rock meets politics for grown-ups.
And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, Kathleen Ronay, Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Before the break, we were just getting into the discussion on the tabling of a bill to change New Hampshire's marriage statute, raising the minimum age to 18. This is something that a lot of people, I don't think, realize, is that under current law, people can get married, 13-year-old girls can get married, 14-year-old boys, with parental consent and a court determination that, quote, special cause exists to make such marriage desirable. This was not a widely known thing, but, you know, certainly the court records indicate that this is something that has happened in sliding numbers, but it still happens in New Hampshire.
Yeah, there are some instances of, I think there are instances of several, you know, young teenage girls getting married to older men and vice versa. I think there was, I think the Monitor had reported there was a case of, you know, like a 29-year-old woman marrying a 15 or 16-year-old, something like
several
that.
Several hundred we're talking about.
Yeah,
it's not a huge number, but
it does happen. But, you know, it was a proposal to basically raise it to 18. And we learned, I learned at the end of the day that this was actually a proposal made by a Girl Scout who was doing her, I think it's called like her Gold Star Project or something. She proposed this legislation. Well, she got a lawmaker to propose
the
legislation for her.
Or something,
right, exactly. And, you know, was pushing this bill through. And I'm not sure what it looked like in its original form.
My understanding originally was to be 16 and that advocates, kind of more professional advocates wanted to raise the age to 18 to create parity with the same-sex marriage law. And there was some resistance, but ultimately, you know, the bill was amended to be
18. Yeah, and I think I had also heard, you know, that some people do think it should be 16 because I believe 16 is the age for sexual consent in New Hampshire.
Yes.
So, that would line up because under this, you know, it would be statutory rape if you have a 14-year-old, having sex with a 25-year-old, but not if you're married. So, advocates from, you know, domestic and sexual violence organizations, I think, had some concerns over that part in particular. But yeah, after the House decided to table this bill, which, you know, is basically the same as killing it. I think they actually moved to indefinitely postpone it.
They indefinitely postponed it,
which is just dead for 2 years. Yeah. Representative Silly stood up and pointed out that there was this Girl Scout was in the gallery. And, you know, how disappointed are we that we were unable to pass her bill? So that was quite interesting.
Well, Dave mentioned some of the arguments made by opponents about military benefits and out of wedlock births. People supporting it argued that it sets up the potential for coercion, although you would hope that having a judge having to sign off would in some way mitigate that a little bit. The argument on military benefits, it's been suggested, I'm not an expert on this, but that you can still assign beneficiaries of your benefits and that out-of-wedlock births are down, so it's not as big of an issue. But again, this, in some ways, this is sort of another mirror image of the culture war argument that I was talking about earlier, where, having a change in the legislature and in the governor's office from, having Republicans in the legislature, Republican governor sort of fundamentally changes sort of the dynamics of the types of legislation we're going to see, the kinds of arguments that prevail, and a lot of these outcomes with postponing and tabling, et cetera.
Yeah, we did see some of the ambivalent nature of the New Hampshire House of Representatives on these culture war issues yesterday, because although they did defeat the transgender rights legislation and the effort to raise the marriage age, they did not pass restrictions on late-term abortions, and they refused to eliminate New Hampshire's law providing a buffer zone around abortion clinics. So.
Well, sort of very conservative in terms of just maintaining the status quo, basically, on all these issues.
Sure.
And on the abortion bills, what we were talking about was, I mean, the buffer zone, that's never really been in place in New Hampshire due to federal court ruling about Massachusetts' buffer zone, which is, I think
there's
35, ours is 25, and there was a non-enforced decision made in New Hampshire. None of the clinics have attempted to set them up, but you know that's going to remain on the books. And on the viability bill, did that set a specific date, or was that just
no? So what that bill did, well, the underlying bill, I mean, the original bill was a bill that did, I believe, set a specific date or like a range, and it would have, you know, criminalized doctors potentially that performed abortions after viability. It would have required doctors to get a second opinion. It would have required lots of statistics to be reported. That was the underlying bill. And there was a move by some Republicans to amend it to basically just say something to the effect of you can't have an abortion after viability as, you know, as determined by a doctor, because it's different for everybody, you know, unless it's for the health and safety of the mother or in a couple other like very specific cases. And, you know, people argue that that is, you know, Roe v. Wade allows states to put their own restrictions on abortion after viability. Roe v. Wade doesn't, set viability at a specific amount of weeks. But yeah, they just defeated the amendment and defeated the bill. I think, you know, there were some Democrats said, you know, if we're going to basically codify this in law, we should also codify the rights provided under Roe v. Wade, saying when you can have an abortion that you are entitled to one. And it seemed like something people just didn't really feel like dealing with. So there was a little bit of debate and then they just killed it.
Yeah.
And buffer zone around the clinics has really become a purely philosophical battleground on the abortion issue in the state because it's had really no practical effect. The law was passed allowing the buffer zones to be put in place around the three clinics in the state where abortion is provided, but none of them have done so. So the effort to have it overturned in the courts was rejected because the court said nobody's been harmed yet, and none of the clinics appear likely to impose them. So it just is part of the ongoing cultural wars.
One thing that sort of loosely falls under the cultural war, but increasingly less of a cultural battle in New Hampshire, is the House's action on a number of marijuana bills. That's become sort of a pedestrian matter for the House to pass a decriminalization bill. But, you know, the Senate has been the graveyard for those things. Kathleen, you have any sense where it's going to be different this year?
I honestly don't have a real good count on where the Senate is at on some of this stuff. I mean, I will say it seems that as a body, the Senate is slightly more conservative this term than it was in past terms. But also, you know, we have this dynamic where we now have a governor who says that he would sign decriminalization. I think if I remember correctly, Governor Hassan was always sort of wishy-washy about it. You didn't know exactly where she was. Beyond decriminalization, they passed bills that would add chronic pain and PTSD to qualifying conditions for medical marijuana. Governor Hassan had said in the past that she would veto something adding PTSD. But there's an interesting argument going on here, especially around chronic pain. You know, you have people saying this may be a better and less addictive solution than giving people opioids. And I wonder if that argument is going to have any sway going forward. They rejected a bill that would have allowed opioid addiction as a qualifying condition for medical marijuana. But I have not done the head count yet in the Senate to see where any of this is at.
Well, Rennie Cushing, State Rep Rennie Cushing from Hampton, one of the lead advocates on marijuana decriminalization and legalization, for that matter, was absolutely ecstatic coming out of the session Wednesday. They felt they had a big day. They won the vote on decriminalization. They won a vote allowing self-cultivation by patients in the medical cannabis program. They added two conditions, and they won a vote creating a commission to study full legalization and retail sales. So this is the year, if ever there was a year. And as Kathleen said, it's going to a big factor will be if Sununu takes a position on this. And
I mean, beyond decriminalization, like, we don't really know. That's where he said, and I think that he certainly signaled that he's not in favor of legalization.
Right.
Well, and these things typically move in stages over time anyway. I mean, I remember back around a few years ago around the medical marijuana debate, all the issues about being adamant about not including PTSD and chronic pain and some of these others. Now they're getting folded back in. And I think, you know, over time, we see in any state that typically legalizes, you see the sort of gradual changes in public opinion and loosening in the rules little by little. And then you get to full legalization. And we've seen Senator Woodburn, a Democrat and the leader in the Senate, come out in favor of legalization.
Okay, we have an email in from Thomas from Milan. He said, I couldn't believe my ears when I heard that the legal age for marriage is in New Hampshire is 13 for girls and boys for 14. like myself, most citizens of New Hampshire are probably ignorant of this, but now they should be outraged. That's Tom from Milan. And just to be clear, Tom, the numbers are that 810 minors have been married in New Hampshire since 1989. So it is not widespread and does require judicial sign-off. But I think a lot of people were shocked to learn that was permitted. We have another question from Twitter, which is the House passed decriminalization. Will Governor Sununu sign it? He told us on Wednesday, yes. Thanks for the comments. Keep them coming. And also call at 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr.org. But it wasn't all social issues in the House this week. There were a couple kind of economic issues on the agenda on the House floor. Minimum wage, the House killed the bill to create a minimum wage at $9.50 that would have kicked up to $12 by 2019. That's no surprise. Yeah. Democrat bill pushed. Republicans, want to leave the state minimum wage sort of to track the federal of $7.50.
Yeah, one of the big concerns there was that by raising it to $9.50, it affects the adjusted minimum wage that people have to offer in the hospitality industry. And where we're competing with the neighboring state that may have $9 minimum wage, we don't want to have the highest minimum hospitality wage in a state that's already having a hard time that needs to keep its edge in the hospitality industry.
All right, let's go to the phone. Dee is on the line from Gilsum. Good morning, Dee. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a transgender woman from Gilsum, New Hampshire. And I was really disturbed by Speaker Jasper's comments that we might be sexual predators in the bathroom that he would need to protect his family from. Regardless of where you stand on the issue, that's just hateful speech.
Well, Dee, it's interesting. If you listen to what he said, he I don't want to sort of put him on the couch here, but he talks about that his natural response would be X, his natural response would be Y. The way he couched it, it was perhaps less about genuinely believing somebody was going to, do harm to his wife or daughter, and just that's how he would react. It's interesting if you go through the various iterations of what he had to say. But was this a bill that you had been following, Dee? Had you been following this until recently, or only when did you become engaged in following this?
Yes, I've been very engaged. I testified before the Health and Human Services Committee and was up there on Wednesday to greet the representatives. But I think if you looked at this issue and you inserted any other group where you would use the word transgender, if you said, if a black person went into the bathroom, I would be outraged and want to attack them. A Jewish person went into the bathroom, I'd be outraged and want to attack them. It wasn't about bathrooms. It was about our right to be employed, to have housing and public accommodations, to not get kicked out of a restaurant if I went out with my kids or the supermarket.
Well, all right, Dee, this issue's obviously not going anywhere. Thanks for calling. All right, Renee is on the line from Contoocook. Good morning, Renee. Go ahead.
Good morning. I wanted to, and I'm a 71-year-old grandmother who is not a part of the transgender community, but I'm a citizen. And I feel like the bathroom issue comes under the history of fear-mongering when anybody is trying to get their rights in this country. It has no basis in fact, and it just always happens when black people wanted their rights. White people would get diseases if black people were at the same water fountain. When women wanted the right to vote, they're irrational and they'll bring down the government if they're allowed to vote. I mean, there are these irrational stories that have no basis in fact. Always happen, and we as citizens need to realize that people have the right not to be discriminated against. All citizens.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Renee. Thank you for the call. It is interesting in terms of the claims that people who wanted to kill the bill that lay on the table were fear-mongering on this. I don't know if you were there, Kathleen, when Majority Leader Hinch was talking to several reporters. David, I think you were there, mm-hmm. when he brought up, well, you know, what happened at the Bedford Target. Yeah. And if you actually look at this sort of Bedford Target incident, what he's referring to was, you know, a 22-year-old man who went into a changing room at Target and used his phone to, you know, take pictures or video images of minor girls changing their clothing. And he was charged with privacy violations. And I believe he received a 6-month suspended sentence and requirements for counseling. But how that incident necessarily has to do with this bill is unclear. Right. But this was an argument that a lot of people were making.
I don't know if that connects, because I don't know if in that situation that individual tried to identify himself as transgender in explaining why he was in the bathroom.
But it
didn't.
I think it's sort of the argument that, you know, supporters of this legislation would make and have made is that, you know, take an instance like this. If someone wants to sexually assault someone in a bathroom, if someone wants to go in and take inappropriate photos, they're probably not waiting for a law to be in place so that they can pretend to be transgender so that they can do that. And that's the argument that people have kind of pushed back on this, that this is suddenly going to put, you know, women and girls at grave risk of something happening.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, the reality with any of this sort of legislation is the perception really drives a lot of the actual behavior, because a lot of this stuff are sort of hypothetical scenarios that are presented by opponents. And in a sort of an interesting way, to me, it sort of raises the debate, when it's somewhat separate, but it raises the debate we're having over you know, voting rights in the state. And it's the same sort of thing. We heard Secretary Gardner say this week that whether or not there's actual voter fraud, there's a perception. And those perceptions can often drive real legislative outcomes, whether that's fair or not. And I talked earlier about the culture war and the tendency when this stuff gets nationalized to kind of caricature the arguments. And I think we're hearing a lot of that reflected in what both Dee and Renee are saying.
All right. Tell us what you think. This is the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You know, you mentioned Secretary Gardner, Dean. One bill that was heard by Senate committee in capacity crowd was actually in Reps Hall was voting, you know, sort of election reform package authored by State Senator Regina Birdsall. You were there, Kathleen. What's in that bill that's relevant?
So what this bill aims the concern of Republicans and people who want tighter voting laws is they're worried that people are kind of exploiting our same-day registration and the ability to sign an affidavit claiming that you are who you say you are and live where you live if you don't have the proper documentation or identification. They're saying this opens the state up to fraud. You know, we know there have been limited fraud prosecutions, and there's not really widespread evidence of fraud, but they're saying the potential for fraud exists. So this bill does a lot, but one of the things it aims to do is put a little bit more scrutiny on people who register within 30 days or on election day to say that to prove they're domiciled in New Hampshire, they have to show some type of verifiable action that they are not just here now, but that they intend to be here. So that could be a driver's license. That could be evidence that they've enrolled their kid at a local school. It could be that they go to a university or that they have a lease that lasts more than 30 days. So having to show this proof at the polls. If you don't, you can still sign an affidavit, but there would be a more robust system for making sure within 10 to 30 days that you were truthful. So there's a lot to unpack in the bill, but basically it aims to crack down on people who register close to election day.
All right. More in a minute. Back after the break on NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Stick around.
Just because you binge-watched West Wing does not mean you understand how government works. And that is okay. NHPR's new podcast, Civics 101, reviews the fundamentals that you learned in school and then forgot. Like, what exactly does a chief of staff do?
Most presidents don't like firing people.
Subscribe to Civics 101 on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Schoolhouse Rock meets politics for grown-ups.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union leader, Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. I have an email from John in Goffstown who says, of me, you told the listener if you listen to Jasper's comment, he said his natural response would be to protect his family. But in reality, if you listen to the comment, it's about this man's bigotry towards something he doesn't understand, and he automatically associates danger and this failure to comprehend others who are different. That's John in Goffstown. Let's get back for a moment to the election law bill we were talking about before the break. You know, that as I mentioned, that hearing was moved to Reps Hall. Election reform, tightening standards is a real priority of Republicans from Governor Sununu, well, from President Trump on down, really, but for certainly Governor Sununu and Republicans in the legislature want to do this. My understanding is that the hearing featured many people who were concerned, but one consequential person in this debate, Bill Gardner, coming out in favor of it. You know, Kathleen, are you expecting this to bounce around a lot more before we get to the end? I mean, this was an amendment that replaced an earlier bill, and, you know, there were some provisions of this bill that certainly some people were worried about.
Yeah, I think one of the things that came up, and I will say there were far more opponents of the legislation than supporters. The supporters were Bill Gardner and a few others that showed up. But there's a provision in this bill that says, okay, you come to vote on election day, you don't have the proper documents, you know, to prove that you intend to stay here, you sign an affidavit, and within 10 to 30 days, depending on how often your town hall's open, you're supposed to return and you're supposed to give this documentation. And if you don't, one of the things that your town could do to verify that you do in fact live where you say you live is to ask local police to come do a checkup at your home to see that you're there and that you live there. And that was a provision that raised a lot of concern among opponents of this bill. They were saying that that amounts to intimidation. We even had the New Hampshire Municipal Association basically saying, we don't really have the, like, our local police have enough to do. Do they necessarily have the resources to do this? Do our town clerks have the resources to do this? Another concern with the bill was that the form is so long. And someone said it's effectively a literacy test because someone might be intimidated by how long the form is. They might not understand what they're signing. They might see the word police and get scared and not sign it and choose not to vote. So I think that and the governor, you know, I asked him on Wednesday how he felt specifically about the police part. And he seemed to say that, you know, he didn't definitively say one way or the other, but said that he might be slightly uncomfortable about that, something to that effect. So I wouldn't be surprised if
that
we see.
Was shed.
Yeah, if we see a little more work on this. But I do think that the basic idea behind this bill is probably going to pass.
Yeah, I mean, and the issue has been, you know, does the Attorney General's office have sufficient resource to look into these cases of people who fill out these affidavits? And they've said they haven't. And there's been some discussion about shifting resources to the Secretary of State's office.
The House did vote on a bill that would
shift the resources. Yeah. Right. I mean, but again, getting back to my earlier comment, the interesting thing here is essentially what Gardner is saying is, and he has said that there isn't evidence in the state of wide-scale systemic voter fraud. But because people believe there is, we need to take these steps in order to shore up trust in the system. I mean, that's essentially the argument that he is making. So it's being driven kind of by a perception or a belief rather than actually addressing, you know, some sort of real systemic voter fraud. And, you know, that's been his argument for a while now.
Well, in the end, it's all going to come down to a legal decision anyway because whatever they get passed is going to be challenged. And this fundamental concept that the Republican majority seems to hold, which is that in order to vote, you have to demonstrate not only that you live here, but that you intend to stay here, is subject to a significant challenge because the Constitution was written with an understanding of the very transient nature of the population, which is why they use the word domicile instead of residency. And whether a commitment to stay is a requirement to vote is definitely going to be challenged.
All right, let's go to the phones. Carol's on the line from Exeter. Good morning, Carol. Go ahead. All right, Carol is not there any longer. Laura is on the line from Nashville. Laura, go ahead.
My comments regarding the bathrooms, and I guess I don't understand why anyone who is uncomfortable using a public bathroom doesn't use a single stall individual bathroom.
All right. Thanks for the tip, Laura. That's potentially a you know, one way around this, but Kevin,
yeah,
go
I would
ahead.
Just note that not every accommodation makes available a single stall bathroom.
Yeah, that would be a tough mandate to pass. Get that through the legislature. You know, a couple more comments from Twitter on the transgender issue. One listener notes. Votes on the bill 478 went down on roll calls. That means you can check to see if your representative was okay with discrimination. That's per someone on Twitter. Another listener says, anyone who assaults another in a bathroom is subject to the same laws that prohibit that behavior. Speaker Jasper's argument is a distraction. And from Sue, she says, I'm a 66-year-old woman who spent much of the previous 2 days in the House gallery. I'm sick of old white men making decisions. That's Sue. Tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. You know, let's move away from the State House slightly and down to Washington. You know, certainly the debate to repeal and replace Obamacare is afoot. Lots of implications for people here. You know, just look at 48,000 people in New Hampshire received insurance through the Obamacare exchange. And if you look at expanded Medicaid, that's another 60,000. And then the broader insurance market, lots of watching, you know, with the Democratic delegation. Not exactly a seat at the table as bills are considered, but Senator Shaheen took to the Senate floor this week to get her views out on the Republican repeal and replace package.
I spent the week that we were back home, not last week, but the week before, talking to constituents in New Hampshire and listening to what their concerns were. And what I heard was that people were deeply, deeply concerned and very upset by the efforts here to repeal the Affordable Care Act when they didn't know what the replacement meant for them.
All right, that was Senator Jeanne Shaheen on the Senate floor talking about the specter of repealing so-called Obamacare. You know, one person who's certainly watching this debate closely is Governor Sununu, who's been pretty chipper on some of the options that are being floated in Washington, such as moving to block grants on Medicaid, which he says we're going to learn more about those shortly. You know, his goal has been keeping current enrollees under expanded Medicaid covered, but you know, he also said he doesn't really believe New Hampshire's Medicaid eligible population is going to grow. But you know, on the specific Obamacare repeal plan now on the table, you know, I think it's fair to call him guarded. Why don't we listen to what he said this week?
I'm very much in favor of repealing and replacing Obamacare with a system that works specifically for New Hampshire. In looking at our cursory review, we've only had about 24 hours to review it. We have some concerns. There's no doubt about that. But as we go through the bill, we really need to look at what are the long-term implications? What are the short-term implications? How does it affect our demographics, our constituencies? There's a lot there to really dig into.
All right. So, you know, not what can we pull out of that?
There's a dynamic in play here, Josh, that could have a significant effect on New Hampshire, which is it now appears that the Trump administration is reaching out to the more conservative wing of their party with a willingness to consider accelerating the cutback on the expansion of Medicaid to the larger eligible population. So if the bill as it now reads has a very slow transition and through the block grants that the Governor Sununu supports that would enable New Hampshire to keep its very successful health protection program, as the expanded Medicaid is called here, in place. But if the president and the party concede to those who say the expansion of Medicaid should be cut off in very short term, we could be hearing a very different tune.
What Dave's referring to is a proposal. Currently, as it stands, it would be 2020. There's been some discussion among conservatives to move that up to 2018. You know, that the House has moved very quickly on this legislation. It's already been reported out of two committees after marathon sessions. You know, the Senate is going to slow it down. And I think that the challenge for President Trump are going to be not only conservatives who are clearly making these kinds of arguments to him, but moderate Republicans. We don't need a lot of moderate Republicans to team up with Democrats in order to block this. And this Medicaid argument, I think, is going to be central for several Republican senators who could join with Democrats to block it. And you know, this is going to be a big argument over just how many people are going to lose insurance, if at all. You know, the Congressional Budget Office hasn't even scored it yet. There have been some just very initial calculations about how many millions of people will be dropped. You know, supporters of the bill say that's not the case. They won't be dropped. They'll have access. And just the whole use of the term access has raised a debate in itself, what they mean by access to insurance. So it feels like it's moving very rapidly right now, and Trump is in sort of wheel and deal mode, meeting with people at the White House every day. But the Senate is going to be really where we're going to see it tested.
Yeah, and I think an interesting component of this, as Josh mentioned, the governor has said that he wants to maintain coverage for people on Medicaid expansion. That's almost 50,000 people in New Hampshire. What's that going to look like? How is that going to be done? And another key piece of this is Medicaid expansion and provides coverage for substance abuse treatment. And the Affordable Care Act says that insurers have to cover that. And it seems like there's some open questions right now as to whether this plan that the House Republicans have put forward would continue to mandate that substance abuse coverage. And Governor Sununu, you know, has said that he's spoken with administration officials and Trump specifically about how it's really important to New Hampshire that substance abuse treatment services are covered. So, you know, the governor isn't saying much right now on how he feels about this, but there's going to be a point where he's going to have to weigh in more on these specific issues and figure out and explain to New Hampshire voters, are they still going to have that coverage? What's his plan to keep people on Medicaid if expansion, in fact, goes away? How is he going to continue to provide insurance for those 50,000 people?
Well, that's one thing on the substance abuse issue. When he's talked about block grants, he's talked about that would be an area where he would like to use the increased flexibility he says could come through block grant to make sure that substance abuse treatment options are robust for, you know, the affected population. And certainly substance abuse was something that was the subject of a large event in Manchester this week for young people. Governor Sununu was there, as was in kind of a surprise cameo appearance, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Why don't we take a listen to what he had to tell the youngsters.
Now in towns all over New Hampshire, from here in Manchester all the way to the Canadian border, you'll find families whose lives have been changed forever because of drug and opioid abuse. Many of you probably know someone who the crisis has affected. You're going to hear from one of those families later this morning, and I hope you'll listen so carefully to their story.
All right, that was U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions in kind of an unannounced appearance at a drug summit in Manchester. I'm sure the kids were electrified by his oratory. You know, it is interesting. This event was an attempt to reach out to youngsters. Obviously, Attorney General Sessions didn't kind of go there, but there was efforts to kind of meet youngsters where they are. You know, whether or not that would be successful, I don't know. But, you know, invitations for people, you know, Ted Gatzis urging people to take selfies, et cetera. You know, but this is Governor Sununu has made reaching out to young people. He believes that, you know, drug prevention curricula in the schools, that New Hampshire has sort of fallen down on the job of reaching out to young people at an age where they would potentially be better equipped to internalize, you know, a message of abstaining from drug use. And, you know, after on Wednesday we had this press briefing, this is one thing he said on that.
The state has to step up and create a baseline minimum that people can buy into and believe in terms of what we're going to do in our prevention programs. And the next thing I want to I'll bring up there in terms of specifics, you know, our prevention programs don't stop at 12th grade. Prevention programs can also enter the workforce. What tools and resources are we giving employers in terms of being part of the prevention programs to say, if you have an employee that might have a substance abuse issue, do you know what to do?
So, Kathleen, you asked what I thought was a good question of Governor Sununu in this context, which was you talk about having these programs in schools. You also talk a lot about local control or you know, would you be prepared to try to mandate this? And you know, he said no, but he certainly indicated a desire to make sure schools had options.
Yeah. And, you know, he brought up a couple things. He said, you know, setting, again, a stronger baseline curriculum that schools can use. So maybe they if they feel lost on how to develop it, you know, they have something that they can use. He also mentioned the potential for some type of matching money for schools to do this, which I've not seen anything like that in his budget. So I'm not exactly sure where that matching money would come from. But yeah, it's this interesting dynamic where you've got a governor who's really, really big on local control, but is also saying, you know, our schools aren't doing a good job here. So how do you walk that line of kind of forcing schools to do better without making it an unfunded mandate? And I think that, you know, we're going to continue to see a big focus from him on prevention. But again, is there money in the budget for it? How are we going to, when's the process going to start for setting these rules? Does that have to happen legislatively? Can it happen through the state board? And there's not, like, there's been a lot of kind of high level talk, but there's not been a lot of tangible action, at least that we've seen so far. And obviously there are other things to focus on, budget, things like that. But I'm curious to see how this actually gets going in a tangible way.
It's certainly something to watch. And another thing that another bit of news that's, you know, politics leached into it, but not explicitly political, was the decision to of the track owners, International Speedway, to you know, move the NASCAR race to another track they're affiliated with in Las Vegas. Obviously, a big hit to New Hampshire tourism. You know, it's estimated that the two races, at least per a 2011 study from Southern New Hampshire University, that the two NASCAR races brought in, you know, around $180 million worth of spending. This the race that would go would be the one that's in September. You know, in the wake of this, there were, you know, kind of tweets from Democrats that, oh, Chris Sununu's lost a business. Then Republicans said that it was really a failure of Maggie Hassan and John Lynch. You know, I think if you actually read this, a big part of it was that the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority offered a sponsorship deal that included $1 million a race and, you know, $500,000 for marketing. This is just simply not something that New Hampshire could compete with, David, right?
Well, the company that owns the New Hampshire Speedway owns one in Las Vegas, too, and it should come as, it really doesn't come as much surprise that they were going to move one of the races there. There's been a concern about this for several years.
Yeah.
It's been a real plus for a state at the size of New Hampshire in the northern part of the country where NASCAR is not as big to have the two races it's had. Fortunately, the one it kept is the July one, which generates more of the additional tourism stay after traffic and revenue. Whether they'll be able to find alternative events remains to be seen. It's highly unlikely they'll find anything that draws a crowd like that second NASCAR race.
All right. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Quickly, next week, what are you going to be doing, Kathleen?
I'll be continuing to watch what happens in the legislature and see if they try to bring the transgender or some other bills back.
All right. David?
Ongoing monitoring of the sausage factory with regard to some of the issues affecting elections and the transgender issue as well.
All right. Thanks, everyone. This has been the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good week.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.